Welcome to the first Poirot Pals post-read debrief, which is many P words all in a row.
Yes. Welcome to, this is the very first one. This is very exciting.
And we are starting with a warning. Chad, warn the people.
We're about to enter spoiler town and the population is many. There are going to be tons of spoilers. We're basically going to start out almost by telling you like what the crime was and who the murderers are. So yeah, just if you haven't read this book and you want to be enjoying a spoiler-free podcast, turn this one off.
Yeah. Press pause. If you don't have your phone available, maybe you're driving, have your friend do it, or just throw your phone out the window. I mean, it's really all you can do at this point.
That's the smartest thing, really, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So once you've done that, we'll give you a second. And now we'll begin. We're in spoiler town.
Yep.
Okay. So mysterious affair. Many mysterious things occur at Stiles. So Chad, tell us what happens in this book. Who dies and who did it?
The crime, Caitlin, is the murder of Emily Inglethorpe, the matriarch of the Stiles estate. And the guilty parties are Alfred and Evelyn.
Dun, dun, dun. We can call them like the murderous cousins.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. I forgot about the cousin part.
So who would have thought, except everybody thought, and then they didn't think it for a while, and then they thought it again. Yep. Which is the plot.
That's great.
And we wanted to start out with who did it, because I found it so satisfying to reread this book knowing that it was Alfred and Evelyn, and it really changed the way that I saw it. So I think we're going to try to give everyone that gift or that experience without having to reread the entire book.
Yes.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah. My experience is very similar. The first time I read it, I felt like it was wonderful and incredible, but I also was like, whoa, that is a very Byzantine-like structure to this thing. But then upon the second reading, all of the things that didn't make sense, or a lot of them, suddenly were like, oh, that's why that's happening. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, I almost see this book as like a really complex, maybe like architecture or even like lace weaving. Yes. That Agatha Christie has put together for us. And it's really hard to see it while you're in it. And so I think what we're going to try to do, because Chad, you and I, it's almost like we have so many ideas, we cannot be contained.
Yes.
So we're going to try to put it into kind of a chapter by chapter debrief. And we're hoping that a lot of the themes and observations that we've collected can kind of unravel in a way that feels natural. And we want to make sure that we're not missing anything. So that's how we'll go about this one. If we hate it, we may change it for the next episode.
Right.
But this is where we are now. Well, Chad, introduce us to Stiles.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Chapter one is titled, I Go to Stiles. And I'm going to just read the first paragraph of this because I think it's super important.
That's perfect.
Because of how it gets set up. Okay. The intense interest aroused in the public by what was known at the time as the Stiles case has now somewhat subsided. Nevertheless, in view of the worldwide notoriety which attended it, I have been asked, both by my friend Poirot and the family themselves, to write an account of the whole story. This, we trust, will effectually silence the sensational rumors which still persist. So that's the setup. Is that this is all Arthur Hastings' account of what happened to get the record straight. That's what the book is, which is,
yeah,
I think, bananas. And also something that is not even followed through on in the least. at all, which is fascinating. Yeah. It's just, yes. So that's how the book starts. Then Hastings is on leave from World War One, and while he's staying in a convalescent home for veterans, he bumps into an old acquaintance who's 15 mm-hmm. years older than he is, by the name of John Cavendish. And they start to kind of talk a little bit. And then Cavendish goes, "Hey, Arthur, why don't you come stay at Stiles? You remember the place where I grew up and lived and you visited when you were younger. And my mother would love to see you." And Hastings is like, "Yeah, this is great. Let's do this." And then you brought up a great point, which is that once Cavendish picks up Hastings at the train station at Stiles, it kind of like sets the tone that this is kind of dark. Yeah, it's not as light as you might think it would be.
It seems as if he's entering into another world. You know, he goes to the train station and he describes it as an absurd little station with no apparent reason for existence, perched up in the midst of green fields and country lanes. It has no reason to be there.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like a fantasy. Mm-hmm. There's another line where it says, "Not so far away, a great war was running its appointed course."
Yeah.
Which is interesting because it's like Stiles is its own world, but it exists within the context of the real world.
Absolutely. And you know, like when you return to somewhere you spent a lot of time in your childhood, everything looks smaller.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm wondering if it's kind of like that, where not only is he going into this place of his memories, but he's going to this place that literally is like removed from the war. Later on, when we talk more about John's mother, there's this note that she made a lot of money off of the war. I think they'd said something about like hundreds turning into thousands because of the war. And so these are like the few people who, when things are bad in the world, their pocketbooks just get bigger. And he literally says, "I had suddenly strayed into another world. Things are feeling safe." And maybe with that, there's almost a sense of like strangeness or yeah. unsettlingness, because you know things aren't safe.
The sense of safety, but starting with Emily, right? She's the mm-hmm. matriarch. She's the mom. She's in charge of everything. She's pulling all of the strings, apparently. One of the things that John Cavendish is mentioning to Hastings quite often is that his mother has recently become married again. And to a much, much younger man, 20 years younger, named Alfred Inglethorpe. So the family is like, the will has been changed to give the money to, I believe, to Alfred, whereas John and his brother Lawrence and John's wife Mary would inherit the estate, but the money would go to Alfred. And so this is like a point of contention. Like, nobody really thinks that Alfred is in love with Emily. They think it's really obvious and that's how we're introduced to this guy. So immediately you're thinking, like, if there's going to be a murderer, it's going to be him. But it's so fascinating how it just goes and you don't think that for a little while. It's really interesting. So now they have arrived at Stiles, John and Hastings. First, they meet Evelyn, who turns out is going to murder John's mom.
Yeah.
But she's really, really incensed and upset already, kind of, that about Alfred. Like, she hates mm-hmm. Alfred. She keeps saying how much she hates him. But then we bump into John's wife, Mary. Ooh. And I just want to, I'm just going to read this and we'll see what happens. But keeping in mind that in theory, John is reading this account. That Hastings, like, this is what, yes. why Hastings is doing it. So this would be in the account that John is reading. "I shall never forget my first sight of Mary Cavendish, her tall, slender form outlined against the bright light, the vivid sense of slumbering fire that seemed to find expression only in those wonderful, tawny eyes of hers. Remarkable eyes, different from any other woman's that I have ever known. The intense power of stillness she possessed, which nevertheless conveyed the impression of a wild, untamed spirit in an exquisitely civilized body. All these things are burnt into my memory.
I shall never forget them. I mean, come on. That's a little bit much, you know?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that passage from that perspective. But right away, Hastings is just like shamelessly drooling after, yeah, the man who like asked him to help, like really, really set things straight.
Right.
He's just like, I also secretly love your wife. Also, though, like, I'm so glad you brought up this passage, because this passage stuck out to me, because there's a sense when we get in the beginning of the story that is that like seriousness. And we'll kind of talk about how that changes throughout. But there's this sense, especially for Hastings, that you don't get in any of the other books, that like this event is deeply important to him personally. And he talks about these events with a lot of nostalgia and like yearning for this past time. And we just get the sense that this is a formative, obviously, this is a formative story for Hastings, first and foremost, not necessarily for anybody else or to like correct the historical record. And we don't ever get this kind of reverence for his accounts of Poirot ever again. So it feels very special. You know, we were talking in the intro episode about like how Styles becomes very important for Agatha Christie too. She names her house Styles. So even though Agatha Christie has no idea what's about to happen to her in terms of her career and like the 70 years she's going to spend with Poirot, it's less than that. I think it's like 50, but like she's going to spend a lot of time with Poirot in her life. That like reverence and importance of this place is already kind of there in Hastings' perspective. So we're back at Mary.
Yeah, so Hastings is drooling all over John's wife, which is just so cool. And so then we get to Styles. We're at Styles. We're at the big house. And we just kind of meet all of the characters. We know John. We've met Mary. We're meeting Emily. And then we meet Lawrence Cavendish, who is John's brother. And then we meet Cynthia, who is a daughter of Mrs. Inglethorpe's friend. So she has kind of an odd trajectory in the story. Then we meet Dorcas, who is the maid, the person in charge of the maids, I believe. And then we've met Evelyn Howard. There's some other people too, including Dr. Bowerstein, who is a really interesting character, someone who Mary spends a lot of time with. And then, of course, Alfred Inglethorpe, who we meet at dinner that night, I believe.
That is a very good, and we'll kind of go into like who they all are later on, but that is a good, like we get, and the speed with which you gave those characters is about the speed with which we get who they are. It's like, I met Styles, boom, 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 I'm meeting everybody.
Yeah.
I do want to note out, though, talking about Hastings meeting Alfred, this is such a funny move for Agatha Christie, because we start to get to know pretty quickly that Hastings is wrong about everything. He, like, he, every assumption he makes is wrong. But when he sees Alfred, he says, from the very first, I took a firm and rooted dislike to him, and I flatter myself that my first judgments are usually very shrewd. So in this way, it's almost like Agatha Christie is like, she's like taunting us a little bit. She's like, Hastings is right here, right away, but I'm going to make him so wrong that you won't believe anything he says or thinks. Even though he's like, yep, he was sinister. I didn't like him. He's going to do something bad. And it's always frustrating too when like you're guessing something and then Hastings guesses it and you're like, well, okay, that's wrong. Yeah. You know, and so he definitely serves, Agatha Christie can tell you, I know you're thinking this, but wait, there's more if Hastings has a guess.
Yes. So the other thing that's really important about chapter one is we do get the first mention of Hercule Poirot. Hastings just kind of casually mentions him and that he had met him one time in Belgium and that he was a very famous detective back then. But we don't know that Poirot is nearby at this point in time. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about in chapter one?
Something I kept returning to that comes up in chapter one. Agatha Christie kind of starts making suspects out of everyone when she starts talking about Emily's money. Because Emily is benevolent. She gives everyone a lot of money, but she never gives them power over her money. So everyone relies on Emily for their livelihood. And I think we learn that John and Lawrence are broke because they don't really have careers. Like, Lawrence is a sad poet.
Yeah. And John wants a larger allowance. Yes. So he can maybe go buy a house of his own. But his mother, Emily, is, like you said, she's definitely generous, but with maybe a purpose, which is to keep everybody around.
Exactly. Yeah. And that makes her interesting and complicated. But also Evelyn, who is such a, she's so manipulative. They're talking about like murder mysteries and things like that. And I think that's when Poirot comes up. And she says that if someone was murdered, even if you couldn't prove it, the family always knows who did it. She says the people that are right in it, the family, you really couldn't hoodwink them. They'd know. And something that comes up over and over and over again throughout the book is John especially being like, God, if Alfred didn't do it, then no one else could have.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. So Evelyn's starting out. She's already playing the game.
Yeah.
By saying that. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah. And she accuses everyone else. She's like, they're all sharks. You know, keep your eyes open. And so she's setting Hastings up to look everywhere else but her. She's a smart one. So yeah, okay. So like chapter one, so much table setting, so many introductions. Chapter two goes over the 16th and 17th of July, which is really, it's pretty much like the day the murder was supposed to happen and then the day the murder does happen. So like Hastings mentions that these 2 days are gone over in great detail at the trial. And he's like, it was so boring. So he's like, I'm going to save you some time and talk about what I want to talk about and what I think is important, which is, again, maybe the tedious version is the version that the Cavendish family is asking for. And he's like, no, right. I want to add some drama and intrigue. But in a way, he is right, though, because these chapters set up so much stuff that's really unclear. And as you're reading, you're like, sometimes I would get slowed down. I'd be like, why do I care? And then, of course, it's like, oh, because of every single little thing that she mentions is important, which is why I think that you and I are like, God, how do we summarize? Like,
yeah,
when every single sentence is loaded with meaning and significance. I think I was telling you, like, when I was a kid, my dad would get really frustrated. The stories I would tell him would go on and on and on. And he would like stop me at some point and be like, Caitlin, you need to learn how to summarize. And I'm still struggling with that.
Like we said, this is her first book.
Like her books get so much breezier and speedier. And there's this like light air to them, I would say, that this one is like a dense, entangled wood. And like her other books are like a beach, you know?
Yes.
I think actually Murder on the Lynx is like also struggles with this glut of detail, almost to a degree where it's like, I wanted to give up reading that one.
Yeah, that's going to be a fun episode. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So bear with us through all of this like meaning laden details and our lack of ability to summarize. And we promise that things will get a little breezier and more fun, which you'll actually hear really soon. And we'll get to that at the end of this episode. So, okay. So I kind of tried to distill it as like there are a couple, just like Poirot, how he's like, I have six clues. To me, I see they're like six really important things that happen in this. The first day, kind of just like things go really well. People are like setting up for one of Emily's charitable events. And I kind of love, this is such a good, I want to slow down. Sorry. This is such a good Emily moment where we get like an insight into her power over this town. She's really charitable. She sets up all these events and like she's the reason why Poirot is there. She's hosting all these refugees. But also like the highlight of her charitable event is that she recites a poem and a poem about the war. And this is total conjecture on my part, but I was like, that sounds really horrible. They just don't want to see this woman who's important because she has a lot of money dictate the entertainment for the night. There is a sense of foreboding. John is acting really nervous. We realize that it's because his relationship with Emily is falling, or with his relationship with Mary is falling apart. Hastings is just like annoyed and he's like sulking around being like, I don't like that Mary is friends with Dr. Bowerstein. I want her attention, even though I have no claim to it. There's that. And then the next, so like that's that first day. And we know now that the murder was supposed to take place on that day. And that Emily is so distracted by all of these events that she forgets to take her medicine.
Yes.
Which will kill her. So on the next day, again, Emily's like, she's super active, but it's also kind of full of all these charged confrontations. It starts out pleasantly enough. She takes Hastings and Lawrence to a luncheon. That was also another opportunity for her to take the medicine and die, but she forgets because she's so excited about all these events. On the way home, the boys decide to visit the dispensary where Cynthia works. We learn that it's because Lawrence has a big crush on Cynthia. I love that also Cynthia, for Hastings, she never gives him a chance to be charming.
Right.
She always makes fun of him. And I think that's something that you and I have both noticed throughout this book, is that something else that's brilliant about what Agatha Christie is doing with Hastings is she's really challenging that notion of like the handsome, intelligent male protagonist who's going to like solve it all. Cynthia is there to remind Hastings that he's a fool.
Yes. And that is also another layer to it, because as the book goes on, we start to realize that Hastings is kind of a fool. But now it's happening with a character also. It's really taking down that concept, like a few pegs, which is great.
This happens when Hastings walks into the dispensary and he's like, oh my God, there are so many bottles here. And she goes, we're really thinking about bestowing a prize on the first individual who does not say, what a lot of bottles. And I know the next thing you're going to say is, how many people have you poisoned?
Right. Yes.
So Cynthia is having none of it. She's not giving Hastings any room to be a charmer. Yeah. And I also wonder if this is coming from Agatha Christie's time in the dispensary, too. I'm sure that here Cynthia is a stand-in for her, also observing people come in and say the same boring thing over and over again and think that they're clever. Then we get this wonderful moment where Poirot enters the scene. The Yay! Three of them. Yes, we get our Poirot. Cynthia is the connection. The three of them are heading home. And Cynthia's like, ah, oh, here's my friend. So we get our beloved Belgian. We learn that Emily's charity is the one supporting Poirot and his other fellow refugees. And honestly, like, I'm going to say this now and then I'll return to it later as we go through the chapters. But I feel like this book and the plot itself is like the birth of Poirot, literally, but also like the plot creates the Poirot that we know. He's like molded and forged in the flames of Styles.
Right, right. And he also yeah. is supposed to have had a career mm-hmm. where he solves crimes.
Yeah.
But we get to know him in this specific instance. Yeah. And that's how, yet, like you said, like he's forged into being.
And the plot itself, like so much of his personality is connected to the mechanics of the plot. He's Belgian. Okay. So because of Emily's charity. So like all of those things that we kind of take as like, oh, these are just character nuances that make him interesting. They're all functions and purpose-driven details in this plot. So it's kind of cool. Like, yeah, like Poirot is, I just imagine him being the plot kind of forming and shaping and creating the little Poirot that we know throughout the rest of his career.
I love that so much because that does like beg the question at some point, why this specific guy? Mm-hmm. Like, why is this? And you're right. It's because he's
Styles.
Created by the plot, by the things that are, yeah. That's fantastic.
The more I was just reading it, I was like, and this is why he says this all the time. And this is why he does this, is because we needed him to have this weird quirk so that we could answer this question about the plot. Again, we get his little tiny frame, his egg-shaped head, and his stiff military mustache. He is downtrodden. He's the humble, downtrodden Poirot that lasts maybe a third of the book. And then by the end, he's like skipping and leaping around. He has a limp, so we get this idea that he's been wounded by the war. But by the end, he is refreshed and invigorated and ready to solve crimes.
Yep.
And then, yeah, we get a sense of how important he is because Hastings tells Cynthia, you've been entertaining a celebrity unawares. Yeah, he's introduced as one of the most celebrated members of the Belgian police, kind of going incognito in this town as a refugee. We see Hastings, when he returns to the house, sees Mary looking upset. and he overhears a confrontation between her and Emily. Mary says, "Why won't you show it to me?" And then we get, "Of course, I might have known you would shield him." And he's not really certain what these words mean. And then later on, we learn that Mary thinks that John, and I guess we learn that he really has been having an affair with Mrs. Rakes.
I think so, yes.
Mary thinks that Emily is holding the proof of this infidelity in her hand. We realize that Emily is holding something else. And I think that's the letter. It's either the letter or the will. I can't remember the timing wise, which one it is. She gets a lot of important papers and is holding them in her hands while she's having arguments this right. day. Yeah. So he hears Emily and Mary argue. And then Cynthia says that she heard Emily and Alfred arguing earlier. Wow. We know later on that it's actually Emily and John, right? And they're yes. arguing about his inheritance. Hastings then sees Alfred. And he says, "The strange unreality of the man struck me." So it's interesting that, like, not on a logical level, but on, like, an emotional, like, spidey sense level, everyone is suspicious of Alfred. The clues are all there and all the logic is there to, like, throw them off. But, like, on a deep human level, they're like, there's something wrong. Yep. And there's a great sense of, like, tension throughout this whole day. It's hot. Mrs. Inglethorpe is, like, fanning herself with a palm leaf. There's a thunderstorm on the way. And we know something bad is about to happen. Also, the fact that it's hot factors in later on with, like, her asking for a fire. But, like,
yeah.
there's a good sense of, like, strange things are afoot at Stiles. The next important thing is that Dr. Bowerstein arrives. He's disheveled and covered in mud. And he's like, "I was looking for a fern." And I guess we know that he was being a spy.
find out that maybe he's a spy. Which is strange. But I think also, like, he is, I believe, one of the world's most sought after specialists for poison, right?
Yes.
It's kind of interesting that he's there in that capacity, right?
Yeah.
So it's just like, it's an interesting thing that he, maybe even more so than Poirot with the Belgian refugees, that makes sense. But the fact that the world's greatest toxicologist or whatever it would be is also there at this time is some pretty interesting timing.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it can make him seem suspicious at first, but then Poirot later on corrects us and he's like, "No, it was suspicious because he's a spy." But Hastings only sees it as a threat. And so he's jealous and cranky about it. He's like, "Dr. Bowerstein is here and he's going to talk to Mary." But this is important because we learn later on that there should not be 6 coffee cups served for after dinner whatevers, but there should be 7 because of the addition of Dr. Bowerstein. The next important thing that happens is Emily asks for her dispatch case and goes to her room. Everyone watches her leave without tasting her coffee, which means that if her coffee was poisoned, she drank it later. Then Alfred goes and makes an excuse that he's going to be out talking about some estate accounts. And he's like, "No one wait up for me. I'm going to be elsewhere when this murder happens." And he's like, "Don't worry, I'll take a key with me and I can get in like later tonight or tomorrow." His excuse later on is that he's lost his key. So that's kind of a key moment, literally a key moment. That's kind of where we end, is like all this setup to the night of the murder. As you're taking it in, none of it is making sense or having any significance. But as you can see, it all does.
Yeah, it's just a ton of detail and quirks and different types of, and you're also seeing it through the eyes of someone who is so strangely petty that he is angry at the world's leading toxicologist because he seems to have a friendship with the wife of another man. So it's a very strange, you're off kilter. So chapter 3 is the night of the tragedy. Lawrence wakes Hastings up in the middle of the night and says that Emily is ill. And you have a great note here, which is like, "I wonder how Hastings could help." Yeah, it's a great, great question. And then we get into this like incredibly complicated series of doors.
Did your book have a map?
It did. I don't find it particularly helpful because it's very hard for me to like read what's happening and then be like, is this where that? But it is so strange. So the basic concept is that there are a number of doors into Emily's master bedroom.
Three, I think. Yeah.
From like Cynthia's bedroom, I think. Mm-hmm. Then also there's a hallway. And then there's another one. And all
Alfred.
Of these. Alfred. Yeah. Thank you. Alfred's. And so all of those are locked. So she has somehow locked herself in and she's having a horrible, seemingly horrible reaction to something or some type of heart problem or something. Eventually, a door is broken down and they run into the room. And then Emily starts to kind of get a little bit better. Maybe like she's not going to perish. Around this time, like Lawrence and Hastings is watching Lawrence and Lawrence is kind of looking past Hastings and he's like, has this look of horror on his face. Like he's seeing something that is even taking his attention away from his potentially dying mother. And then Emily all of a sudden has another massive series of convulsions and dies. Dr. Bauerstein comes in, just happens to be the world's leading toxicologist.
He's like, oh, hey.
Yeah. Oh, hey, man. What's up? It's so great. As Emily expires, she says, Alfred, Alfred. And so Bauerstein tries to resuscitate her and it does not work. Then another doctor comes in who's like the town physician. The doctors discuss it. And then Hastings starts to kind of opine about like what has been happening. Oh, he mentions that he has a certain talent for deduction. And Dr. Bauerstein has started a flock of wild surmises. He's basically thinking Bauerstein might have had something to do with it, which is an interesting idea. Oh, and it's important to also know that Alfred is not in the house when his wife dies.
He made that clear in the previous chapter. He's like, I am leaving.
Am I remembering this right? That John and Lawrence have opposite ideas about whether or not there should be a postmortem. Like John thinks there should be, and Lawrence is like, we just should let it go. And also, this is interesting because like they're talking about this moments after their mother has passed. Well, their stepmother has passed. And then Hastings, with his one good idea for the entire book, this is it. He suggests bringing Poirot on board to investigate the case. And John says, listen, I don't want this in the papers. I don't want I don't want all the sensationalism about this. Yeah, you wrote, Poirot is discretion itself. That's a great line. That's how Hastings describes him.
The one thing that I just noted was kind of funny is like when Emily dies, and I think Dr. Wilkins is like, it could be something else. He says, nature rebelled.
Yes.
And I thought that was so interesting because it's like, it almost seems like if we take it as not talking about like, oh, she had a heart attack or something, but like, it almost seems like it's saying that this older woman, of course, could not be with this younger man. And so something sinister had to happen. Nature's putting things in its right order.
That's freaking great. I totally did not get that level on that. And that's really cool because that's exactly what he's saying.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So he's
kind of. But he doesn't know it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird little condemnation of the dead woman.
Yeah. And he also says, and this riled me, but I do wonder if Agatha Christie's, it's one of those things where it's like, is she putting this in here to make this person look foolish? Or is she condoning this stereotype or this assumption about women or people of other races or whatever it is? Is she making fun of them? Or is she agreeing with them? And sometimes the line is blurry. But the doctor says her zeal for good works was too great. Which is like, this woman was too good at being a human. She had to die.
Yeah. Yeah. And I believe that when Alfred, in the next chapter, returns, he also has that matter-of-fact sort of, well, she's been working too hard. She's been doing too many things. All that's just like what the men are saying.
Knowing that it's Agatha Christie who's saying that, I have a feeling she is making them look silly and dumb. Yeah, because she'll do that a lot. She uses people's assumptions about how they think the world is to make them be wrong. Okay, great. So then we get Enter Poirot, right? The next chapter, Poirot investigates. This chapter is where we gather clues, because the clues are either, they're a little bit more pointed than the previous days, you know, where we're like, here's the setup to her murder. All of this information that doesn't seem to be significant. This is where we start, like, kind of honing in on Alfred, but also Poirot is definitely, like, seeing significance in things that we wouldn't necessarily see as significant. Like, Hastings kind of criticizes Poirot and says he's past his prime, like, he's kind of, like, foolish and old. And so Agatha Christie, this is, I feel like, her first risk she's taking, where she's like, you've got to stick with me. I mean, she's published book. No, wait, this is her first book. Yeah. She doesn't have that clout of authority where she's like, I am a weaver of mysteries and plots. Trust me. Right. So like reading this is the next time I was like, this would be a point where maybe the reader would put the book down. We know everything is there for a reason. Yeah, I call this chapter like the clue fire hose, where it's like one important thing after the other, but we have to take a leap of faith that everything is important.
Yeah, I think like yeah. There's something to this chapter that is so looking back at then what happens with the rest of Agatha Christie's career and the Belgian detective. This is like the introduction to his kind of brilliant but sideways perspective. But this is where the Poirot, who is not just, I want to say, not just like a stranger in a strange land sort of thing, but also observationally and intellectually is a stranger in a strange
land. Yeah. The first thing we get, even before we kind of go on this clue seeking, is really the establishment of like the Hastings-Poirot dynamic that will get reprised kind of throughout the Poirot books. And especially in like the TV shows later on and the short stories. Hastings is like, okay, Poirot, I need your help. Let me tell you everything. And Poirot's like, oh, you have given me the facts faithfully. Of the order in which you present them, I say nothing. Truly, it is deplorable. But I make allowances. You're upset. Yeah. So he's like, oh, you poor, stupid thing. And then I just want to one more just kind of setting up how kind. And Poirot was never, he's never upset by people misunderstanding him. He'll be upset by something that he's done. Like he'll make a mistake or he'll not see something and that upsets him. But he's always very calm. His gaze upon the world is very calm and amused, I would say. So like when he's talking to Hastings, he's like, the mind is confused, is it not? Take your time. You're agitated. You're excited, but it's natural. Presently, when we're calmer. And I think this also kind of, this is his approach we're getting. He says, we will arrange the facts neatly, each in his proper place. And I love that he gives the facts a gender because he's French. So he's like, each in his proper place. We'll examine and reject those things of importance we'll put on one side, and those of importance, poof, we will blow them away. She's kind of saying, we're about to enter this crazy whirlwind of clues. Trust that Poirot is going to arrange them for you.
Yes.
And that's the kind of leap of faith she's asking us to take. Yeah, and it's great because, like, again, Hastings is there to be made fun of. And I could just see Hastings being really fun to write, especially if you're, like, a woman in this time period where you're probably not getting taken seriously at all. Poirot asks if Emily ate well that night. And, of course, Hastings doesn't see the connection, but he's already thinking poison and kind of looking at the timing of her death. And Hastings is like, I think the war has affected his brain. And I love this point, too. So, like, when Poirot goes to Styles, we kind of get the, like, sad, ominous atmosphere that we've set up really gets turned on its head. And, like, I think this is Christie kind of saying, I started you off here with this, like, kind of spooky, tense start. Now I'm just going to turn everything on its head and we're going to get really wacky. Poirot, like, looks, he's like, he and Hastings are approaching Styles and he looks out over this estate And we get Poirot stop for a moment and gaze sorrowfully over the beautiful expanse of the park, still glittering with morning dew. So beautiful, so beautiful. And yet the poor family, plunged in sorrow, prostrated with grief. So he's kind of expecting this, like, a tragedy, basically. Yeah. And then he goes in and everybody's having breakfast and nobody's really bothered at all that Emily's dead. And so I feel like this is where we start to change. The real Styles has kind of been revealed and it's much more cynical. And it kind of says, like, it's okay, you don't have to be sad about Emily either. Like, let's just have fun on this mystery right now, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's part of the tone change is, I'm guessing, intentional. But so now we're in strictly novel mode. Now it's it's like, this is a mystery, and kind of forget this little setup at the beginning.
Yeah. And John is more concerned. He's like, how do I treat Alfred? He's like, oh, he's so weird. And I love it because Poirot says that difficulty won't exist for long. So I'm like, okay, Poirot. And Poirot even says, he's like, well, Alfred has the most to gain. So automatically I assumed it was him and I just had to figure out how he did it. So, okay, we get the clues in Emily's bedroom, and then we get Dorcas and Annie. So Poirot, being the, like, neat man he is, he's like, I have 6 points of interest in this room. We get the coffee cup smashed on the ground. We know that Lawrence did that later on because he thinks that Cynthia was the one who poisoned Emily. We get a stain on the floor, the dispatch case, the fragment of dark green fabric, the splash of candle grease that we know is not Lawrence's, it's not Emily's. And Poirot says, I'll keep the last clue to myself. But we realize that it is the bromide powders, which are key later on. Poirot and Hastings find the fragment of the will in the fireplace. So we know that Emily has burned a will. And then Poirot is like, the begonias, which I think he does that exact same thing in Murder on the Lynx.
Yes, yes.
He's like, the flowers. And they're like, why do you care about the flowers? So anyways, he's kind of starting to figure out that the gardeners would have been around there. And so, you know, of course, and I wonder, too, if, like, the gardeners signing the will, that's such a mystery cliche almost.
Yes.
The gardeners or the house staff is always brought in to sign a will, and you have to find them like 30 years later. And they're like, yes, I remember the day when I signed the will. Anyways. So we get that. And then we have this discussion with Dorcas. So she also, you know, right away is like, Alfred has a weird vibe. And so that goes to what Evie's saying, like, even if you can't prove it, everyone knows. And here we get Dorcas saying he was weird. She reports about Emily's argument with Alfred / John. And she says that Emily has a piece of paper in her hand. And she says these few words and everything has changed. And I believe we know at that point that it's the letter that Alfred writes to Evie, right?
I believe so, yes.
We talk to Annie, who is another servant. And kind of the biggest thing that comes out of this discussion is she's like, there was no salt in the hot chocolate. So, like, she is so concerned that she accidentally put salt in Emily's hot cocoa. And Hastings jumps to the conclusion that it was strychnine. And Poirot says this great thing where he's like, the salt could just be salt. Like, don't worry. And I think we realize that later on it's a narcotic. Mary has slipped Cynthia and Emily narcotics so that she can go search for the proof that John has been cheating on her. This chapter ends with a great spooky part where we get this piece of paper found in the trash with Emily's handwriting. And it says, he is possessed, I am possessed. And it's a great cliffhanger. What a spooky way to end a chapter. Yeah. Soon it's debunked and we realize it's a blotting paper and she's trying to, like, write possessed, but she forgets how to spell it. But I just loved, you know, I was thinking about, like, what other kind of genres are around at the time. And I know that, like, this is a time of, like, seances and things like that. And so I wonder if she's aware that her audience would be, like, really intrigued by the occult. And it feels like a little gift for making your way through this really intense chapter of clues.
It's really difficult to explain what each one of those things means to the story until you get to the very end. Mm-hmm. But everything in there is not what it seems, mm-hmm. including the he is possessed, I am possessed. Like, you can kind of start to put together, like, well, maybe this is how it happened or this is how it happened. And it doesn't ever work out that way. No. it's just yeah. like everything is like, it has so many different layers to it.
And maybe in that way we can be a little forgiving to Hastings. Yes. He's like, God, I'm trying to figure this out.
Right. Hastings' big problem for me, and although it's delightful, is in his head, the competition with Perrault. Right. Like, he thinks that he's onto something and it's like, you're not even in the same universe. Now we're going into chapter 5, which is entitled, It Isn't Strychnine, Is It? And it turns out, a little from column A, a little from column B, maybe. This is a weird chapter because mm-hmm. there's so much detail in it and we've already touched on a lot of it. It's really something that maybe we don't need to discuss
no.
a ton. One of the things that is interesting, yeah, is that Perrault is almost being more emotional than the family members mm-hmm. who are kind of starting to get in sniping mode a little bit. And Perrault proclaims how much he cares for the case. Tears came into his eyes. And all this, you see, I think of that poor Mrs. Inglethorpe who is dead. She was not extravagantly loved, no, but she was very good to us Belgians. And that's like, kind of more than anybody has said about her.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of interesting. And so this is a very sort of, I don't even know if I would call it a setting the table chapter yeah. as much as it's just kind of rearranging the table.
Totally. And it's almost like he's running a lot of tests. It's yes. like, it's like if you walk into a lab and you're like watching someone in the middle of all their tests.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, how do I explain it? But fortunately for us, like, I think we covered a lot of things that are explained in this chapter, and we'll also kind of cover a lot of them later on. So you had kind of mentioned, Chad, that there are like technically almost three trials in here, because we get the one that Alfred will eventually have, but we don't really see on camera or in the book, John's trial. And then we also get the inquest. And so I did a little bit of research about like British inquests because I was really curious about them because they always show up in like British mysteries. In an inquest, you're trying to not prove who did it, but you're basically trying to like, there are some rules. It's like you have to identify like who the victim is and how they died, but it's presented by a coroner and also decided by a jury. And that's kind of the weird thing.
To me, it makes sense through what you were saying, like British TV yeah. shows and things like that. And so, yeah, it's very interesting. I will say that I watched the Masterpiece Mystery version of The Mysterious Affair at Styles, and it helped me understand the inquest scene, the difference between that and a trial.
This chapter really functions as refining the case, like further refining chapter 4. We get rid of some theories and everything really starts pointing to Alfred. And even later, this is where Poirot is like, the case for Alfred is too strong. And if there's one bit of contradictory information, it can ruin the whole thing. It reminds me of when I'm like teaching my students about writing a thesis. And I'm like, if you are too certain of your thesis and say that you are 100% right, if you're like wrong in any little way, then like your whole paper falls apart. So I'm like, don't like couch what you're saying.
Yeah.
Add a perhaps or a maybe. And that's kind of what is happening here. And Poirot is starting to get really suspicious.
It's a really interesting tension that comes in because it's almost like everybody else is like, we know who did this, right? Like this yeah. is, let's get this trial going. And Poirot's out in front of it.
We kind of get the sense that Poirot is running around in the background, figuring things out. And Hastings is pouty again. And he's like, I rather resented his not taking me into his confidence, the more so as I could not in the least guess what he was driving at. And it's great because later on, Poirot is like, I couldn't tell you because you have zero chill. Right. He's like, if I right. told you I knew it was Alfred, you would have given it away so quickly. So he was like, I had to yes. keep it from you, which I love.
It's amazing.
So yeah. So basically like the inquest, we confirm some things, we get rid of some things. We know Emily died of strychnine. We know the cocoa didn't have strychnine in it. The coffee could have contained strychnine, I guess. Mm-hmm. But again, she doesn't drink it. Did we ever figure out none of the coffee has strychnine in it? That could go into the shelf of things we're confused about. But either way, like, the coffee should be taken off the table. It should be thrown on the ground and stomped on because it doesn't matter.
And also, who's drinking coffee at 8 p.m.?
Yeah. That's the big question of the
book. That's really the mystery at Styles. Yeah. But I think there is something important with the contradictions that Alfred has during the inquest. Things that people had definitely witnessed him doing or saying, he just blatantly says, no, that's wrong.
Yeah, and even Poirot says to Hastings, he's like, does this imbecile of a man want to be arrested? And I do wonder, I think Poirot definitely knows what's going on here. I think he's trying, because Poirot said, he was like, Hastings, I gave you the clues. It was your fault you didn't pick them up. Right. So I think at this point, I do wonder if he's saying this for Hastings, because, you know, there was a moment where he doubted a little bit, and then the inquest is actually where Poirot was like, okay, this guy is trying so hard to be arrested, he has to be guilty. Evelyn is really vehement in her testimony against Albert, which is suspicious. Mary is cagey, but I think at some point she actually thinks that she is the murderer. But either way, she's guilty because she's, like, drugged her aunt and her family friend in search of this paper. So that's all explained. But really, Alfred looks super guilty, and the verdict is that Emily's death is a murder. And the last little bit we get in this is that we get, I'm going to call him Inspector J. I don't know if you saw my notes about this.
Oh, sure.
But this inspector from Scotland Yard is a reoccurring character in the Poirot series. His full name is a racial slur. So we're going to call him Inspector J. And it's interesting that, like, even in the Japanese, and there are manga versions of Poirot, which I think is really cool.
Ooh, wow.
His name is changed to Sharp. Because
that's great.
Of the unfortunate spelling of his name. He is an old friend of Poirot, and so Poirot has a connection then with Scotland Yard, and he's able to work with them to solve this case. It also kind of bolsters Poirot's street cred a little bit, just as like an authority on crime.
Yeah, Inspector J's boss is like, we should definitely arrest Alfred. Like, we should do it, and because there's enough evidence. And Poirot talks to Inspector J, and Inspector J's like, I trust Poirot.
Yeah.
He's always right. So we're starting to see how great Poirot is.
And it's so interesting, too, because even the introduction of Inspector J as a character serves to help us solve this case, to solve Styles in a persuasive way. Like, yes. Poirot couldn't have done it on its own. So here we get this character, Inspector J. Surprise, surprise, he becomes a staple character of the Poirot series. So again, like, all of this stuff, the plot gives us all these characters that, like, flourish and do all these different interesting things later on. But they kind of start here for very practical purposes.
I think we've gotten into chapter 7 now.
Yeah.
Poirot pays his debts.
I love that title.
Which is a great, great title. I think, like, one of the most important things, at least I remember this from reading it, was when Poirot says to Hastings that the evidence is too conclusive. Real evidence is usually vague and unsatisfactory. It has to be examined, sifted. But here the whole thing is cut and dried. No, my friend, this evidence has been very cleverly manufactured. So cleverly that it has defeated his own ends. That is exactly what has been happening. It's all of the clues that we've been given as readers, Poirot is now explaining them to us, which is, I love that. So, yeah.
And doesn't, like, right around there, Hastings, he's like, I could only conclude that Poirot was mad.
Right, yes.
And he's like, nah, listen to me. I love that Alfred is really surprised when Poirot helps him out.
Air quotes.
And
yes.
And so that should be, like, a big indicator. He's like, what? You actually prove that I'm innocent? Dang.
Poirot has gone and found 5 witnesses that can speak to Alfred not lying on the stand during the inquest. And because of that, then they can't charge him.
Exactly. And so this is where we get, like, all of the book has really been like, Alfred, 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 Alfred. And then Poirot's like, stop looking at Alfred. And this is where we get the next shift, which I think it's interesting. You had texted me before we started that you found that this book was published in what, 20 different like serial,
yes,
like sections.
First published between February and June of 1920.
Ugh, what months to be alive. We can imagine that this moment, if you're reading this serial, you're just like, what? Right. And I also think maybe that makes me like go back and revise some of what I said about, and maybe I even said this in our last episode, but I'm saying it, I'm re-realizing it again, yes, that the Clue chapters are probably really fun. If you are reading this as a serial, you know, you're like, oh, I'm going to do the crossword puzzle. Then I'm going to read this mystery story and I'm going to like check in on my clues. I can see it for the reader just being like frustrating. And I can see people just like taking their notes and like tearing them up and throwing them out the window. Fresh suspicions is basically like, I mean, it's exactly how it sounds. We have to start coming up with someone else, you know,
yes,
now that Alfred is proved innocent. We need to like start from the drawing board. And even Poirot says, he's like, okay, we've cleared away the manufactured clues. Now we have to get to the real ones, which I can imagine too. Like, I know that we have the mystery novel established at this point, but this really doesn't, I mean, even in like a Sherlock Holmes, I haven't, for as much as I can remember, I haven't really encountered anything where it's like you spend all this time and effort pulling at these threads that then you just have to like throw away.
Yep.
Halfway through the book or two thirds. Yeah.
The book almost lost me at the inquest because I was like, are we going into a law setting now with this? Okay. What's happening?
Yes.
But I did find it. I found this chapter to be where it takes off.
Well, yeah. And it's really interesting because he's kind of like off to the races. He's like, Hastings, go stand in that hallway, you know, like, and then he's like, okay. And so he really starts like, you can tell he's already been thinking about, okay, now if I take away all these things, what am I left with? And what do I have to figure out? And he's just kind of going. He starts also like debunking things. He's like, okay, we've got the hallway test. Poirot does kind of throw Hastings a bone for a second. And Poirot's like, okay, we need to rethink our approach. Hastings, who do you think it is? And he asks Hastings for ideas. And it's interesting because Hastings is like, well, Evie's kind of weird.
Right.
And so there's this sweet moment where like you can see Poirot trying to kind of, he's like, you're so close and I can't tell you because of who you are. But like, let's try to figure this out. And then we also get that wonderful message that Poirot asks Hastings to deliver to Lawrence. There are so many things. It's mysterious. It shows us that Poirot is on the right track. We have no idea what he's talking about. It's in the act. It's so tender because you know that he cares about Lawrence and he sees exactly what's going on with Lawrence, why he's so mopey. But at the same time, it's almost a threat too, because he says, find the extra coffee cup and you can rest in peace. And that phrase, rest in peace, it's like, he can die.
Right. Right. Especially given the context, right? Yeah. With his mom passing. You're right, though, when Hastings does go to Lawrence and say that, and Lawrence is like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like initially, like, what the? But then like when Hastings comes back to Poirot and says, yeah, I told Lawrence what you said, and he was really confused and didn't make any sense. And Poirot's like, yeah, sure. That makes sense. Yeah, that tracks.
Good. Yeah.
Basically, yeah. But it ends up having the desired effect.
Yeah, exactly. Like you had said when you were kind of lost in the inquest, this picks back up in a way that it's like, we have to trust Poirot because nothing makes sense.
Yeah.
I was so fascinated comparing, because I did re-listen to the Phoebe Reads version of this, which is actually, I didn't realize that it was the first Phoebe Reads book, which I think is also kind of a lovely thing that this is Agatha Christie's first book and it like flourished into this amazing series. And then like Phoebe Reed starts with Styles and it also flourishes into its own wonderful series.
Yes.
But in the comparison, I realized that I had a more, an unupdated version of the text in terms of things that have been removed because of their problematic nature.
Interesting.
And that really occurs in chapter 8. And that's, I think, when I was texting you, like, what is going on with this book? And you were like, I think we have different versions. But there's this really interesting thing that happens with Dorcas. I am just going to have this as like a question that I'm going to put to you, but also to our readers about like, what do you think is going on here? because she kind of paints Dorcas as, in my version, a naive person, more like uneducated or more enlightened person of a certain class. And so I wonder if she's kind of trying to not make fun of, but call out closed-mindedness. And the closed-mindedness is coming from Dorcas. Or...
interesting.
Is she not at all? And Dorcas just saying these wildly racist things. So I just...
yeah.
I can't tell. But basically, in my copy of the book, Poirot, Hastings, and Dorcas go to the attic because they're looking for the green dress. We learn later on the green dress isn't a dress at all. But we find, intentionally, because Evie hoped we would find it, the, like, Alfred wig.
And beard.
Yeah, and beard. Yeah, yeah. And it's in this costume box. The problematic costume box. That's what we'll call it. But a passage that was removed in later versions of the book, Dorcas talks about how Poirot is a quote-unquote good kind of foreigner, which I think is, you know, something that we haven't touched upon yet, but I think we will as we move through this, is, like, all the different versions of an outsider and who's an acceptable outsider and who's not. And, you know, we talk about how Poirot is, like, kind of quote unquote, you and I had even observed, like, yes, people treat him differently. They think he's funny, but they're not outwardly prejudiced towards him. And they don't see him as quote unquote, like, sinister or
right.
inevitably bad because of who he is. And she even just, like, says that out loud. And so it's interesting that, like, future versions took that out, but it only gets worse because we learn that the costume chest is used for tableaus, which is like a kind of holdover from the Victorian era where you dress up and like do famous images or paintings, but you're like still and kind of in this frame. And we learn that Cynthia particularly loves to dress up as men of different ethnicities. Basically, we learned that Cynthia is doing kind of black and brown face, and a lot of that is cut and kind of tamed. It gets tamed in Phoebe Reed's that version.
Yeah.
And in mine, it's pretty explicit.
Yeah, I think Phoebe's reading the same one that I did.
Okay, yeah.
From the, yeah, and I call her Phoebe also, because we're all friends.
Yeah, yeah, all we all know each other.
Like, we're super tight.
Colleagues.
Colleagues, right, the perfect word. One of the reasons why I didn't read Agatha Christie for a while was because of what I had heard and what I remembered of the books that I read a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's an attempt at commentary, I think there's probably a good reason why those words were taken out.
Yeah. And that's, I guess that's my big question is like, even if she is making someone look foolish for saying those things, she's still saying those things. You know?
Yes.
So it's like, well, how much leeway do we really give her? Right. And I don't know. And I think I definitely want to put this question to our readers about, like, you know, removing text and things like that, because I feel like I'm not an authority by any means on, like, whether you should keep texts the way they are or remove them. But, you know, I do know that, like, a lot of Agatha Christie's books have been updated, and it does allow them to be enjoyed for future generations, but does that also stifle the conversation about like the world in which these cultural products came from? My answer is I don't know, and I don't think I should be the one to decide. But this chapter really kind of hits home, whoa, this was from a very, I don't want to say very different, because a lot of these things, of course, are still around, but just in very different and more like insidious forms as opposed to really overt. And so here I'm like moving on, but also not moving on because we don't just want to brush past it. But the last point of significance, and I'm so curious to hear what you think about this, is Poirot's weird conversation with Evelyn. I don't know if you remember this part, but basically like Poirot's like, hey, Hastings, we need an accomplice in the house. So let's get someone to work for us. They're like, okay, let's get Evelyn to work on our side. And I'm pretty sure that Poirot knows exactly what he's doing. He knows that she's guilty and he's going to play with her. Kind of like a cat with green glowing eyes playing with a little mouse.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes. But like, so their conversation, it's very coded. And it's so funny because even at one point, Hastings is like, you don't realize that I'm still in the dark. And Poirot's like, two is enough for a secret. But basically what happens is he asks her if she thinks that Alfred poisoned Emily. And she's like, no, I hate him. And Poirot's like, deep down, I know your instincts point away from Alfred. And then he says, whose side will she be on when all is revealed? And I think it just means like, if Alfred comes to the surface, are you just going to let him hang for your crimes as well? Like, are you going to throw him under the bus, basically? Then she has this really weird monologue where she kind of goes back and she just says all this nonsense. And then she puts her head in her hands and she goes, that was not Evelyn Howard who spoke. This is Evelyn Howard and she's on the side of justice. So it's like,
yeah,
did she let herself slip into who she really was, and then she dialed back, and it's just extremely awkward. Like, if you think about a person in front of you saying all this weird stuff, then quietly holding their head in their hands and then being like, that wasn't me who just spoke, this is the real me, it's like, what is happening?
Yeah, it's a very weird conversation. Mm-hmm. I think there's also a component of it too, the way that Poirot comes out of the conversation, making it seem like he trusts Evelyn and that she's on the side of justice. I think he is doing that to fool Hastings. Because again, Hastings' natural inclination to just be himself can't be onto this. So this is his way, I think, of just kind of making sure that Hastings isn't anywhere near the trail.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. And he understands that Evelyn is guilty, so he doesn't mind playing with her like the cat and the mouse. Yeah, right?
Totally. Yeah. It's a weird moment. And he does say, he's like, the culprit is really smart. We have to make ourselves look dumb here. And yes. So he's doing, but the way, I just love the like charged exchange between these two really smart, brilliant people who are kind of mind melding, but also not. And Hastings is just on the outside, like, why aren't you telling me? And I actually had this thought at the end of the chapter. Maybe we can talk about this a little bit, like throughout the book, but like Hastings ends the chapter being really cranky because Poirot basically says, you have all the facts, dude, figure it out. And at this point I was looking at Hastings and I was like, yeah, okay. He is kind of cranky and he's always sulking, but like, Poirot was asking Hastings to do a lot. And he's like, have faith in me. This book is like, have faith in Poirot as though you would have faith in like a god. It's like, have, you know, like God works in mysterious ways.
Yeah.
And so does Poirot. And kind of in a sharp contrast to like the weird racist attic scene that we just saw, it is cool that Poirot is this outsider and his brain is working differently than everyone else's. And you do, like, Agatha Christie is like, have faith in someone who thinks differently than you and who's coming from like a different cultural background and norms. We need to trust that Poirot does have a quote unquote method, even if it's different than what you would see as normal. And so in this way, it's like this really like tender love for this outsider. And I think that's kind of really powerful. That like is a message of allowing people so much grace when you don't understand them.
Yes.
Which I think for in like 1920, I'm sure the world needed more of that. Yeah. And it still does. And so, yeah, that's why I feel so conflicted too, because it's such a, it's a champion of the misunderstood. And it's like, hey, maybe the person who frustrates you and you don't understand what they're thinking, maybe they're onto something and they're approaching it from a different way. Like, don't be a Hastings.
Right. There's also a openness of thought that Hastings does not have. A sense of discovering the truth of what happened rather than just taking the easy way out.
Chapter 8. Complicated chapter.
Complicated chapter. Chapter 9 is just titled Dr. Bauerstein. So the main thing that happens kind of, we find out that Bauerstein has been arrested. But there is maybe my favorite part of the whole book.
Yes.
As you have just said it perfectly, it's the awkward proposal. Mm-hmm. And there's this scene where Cynthia is talking with Hastings and she's really down with the way the will has been written, she likely won't be taken care of anymore the way that she has been. And she's trying to figure out what to do with her life. And Hastings just sees like attractive young woman who's lost and can't find her way. And so he does the thing that men do, which is that he just kind of like sits up straight. And this is just in my mind thinking of this. Mm-hmm. And then he proposes to her. He doesn't know her at all. Uh-uh. And he proposes to her and her response is so great. And then go ahead and, because you have such a great voice, could you read what Cynthia says?
Oh, yeah. She says, and this is so, because I think she laughs at him, right? Which is gorgeous. laughing in his face, which we know is like the most threatening thing that can happen to a man. And she says, somebody might accept you next time. Goodbye. You've cheered me up very much. And then, Agatha Christie says, and with a final uncontrollable burst of merriment, she vanished through the trees.
It's so great. It's so Hastings. Like, mm-hmm. It's just that, of course, he would do that. And I love that Cynthia, like, then was able to just be like, that is absurd. That, what are you talking about? Like, I'm just upset. Let me have my emotions and be in my feelings for a good reason, right? And I love it also isn't that she's thrilled that someone would ask her to marry him. That's not why she's joyful. She's joyful just because of how stupid it was. Like that's it's not like someone would love me. That's not it. It's like, that was just insane, dude.
Yeah. She's like, what are you doing? And also before that, I love it. Cause like, she's like, oh, can I confide in you? Because you like kind of seem like you have your stuff together. Like I see you as like, she's kind of like, I could see you as like a mentor or somebody who could like help mm-hmm. me through this difficult time. Yes. So that just like totally fans his ego. And he's like, suddenly she was more beautiful than even Mary.
Right.
So he's like, one compliment. And he's just like, well, I'm going to change my whole life and the life of this poor young woman.
I've had so many great conversations with some of my friends who are women about the level of just absolutely intense privilege that straight cis white dudes have when it comes to they've decided that they've fallen in love and that there's nothing that will stop this now, even though, and this is really like a perfect example of it. You know, a guy for 3 days or whatever, and he proposes to you and he's just absolutely certain that mm-hmm. it'd be the best thing for you and him.
Yeah.
And that is just, that's just so great.
Ugh. Yeah. And it's like, wow, thank you for doing me such a favor by like right. pushing your way into my life.
Right.
And in this way too, like all the women in this book are so fascinating. They're so independent. Even Emily, she's like independent. She's controlling, but she's powerful. And Cynthia is smart and a scientist and like studying medicine, which, you know, I think either John or Lawrence did, and they just gave up.
Right.
And Mary, too, is like so independent. So we get these really cool women in this book. And I think that's also something to appreciate about how powerful this book was, and that also it was so popular, too. We get the arrest next. And I have to say, I love the sleight of hand that this chapter title kind of pulls, because we think, okay, it's about Dr. Bowerstein. So we're like, okay, it's going to be about Bowerstein's arrest. And then no, at the end, total surprise, John is arrested for the murder.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, she's so sneaky. It unravels some threads of suspicion and it kind of sets up some other ones. Because I think we had Alfred, then as we said, fresh suspicions, Bowerstein, and then we're moving to John. So it's kind of like our focus is just kind of moving throughout these people.
And also, Poirot has had nothing to do with Bowerstein's arrest or John's arrest. This is like Scotland Yard making the arrests.
Yeah.
Or something, or the equivalent, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because I think he could have said something to prevent John from being arrested, but he decides not to. So we get basically, we find out that Bowerstein is a German spy. And it's so funny because Poirot, because like Hastings is like, it's Bowerstein. He's like telling everybody, or he's telling John it was. And then Poirot is like, whoever said it was Bowerstein? He's right. Like, that's a dumb idea. And he says that Bauerstein is a German spy. And I was a little confused by that because Poirot had said he admired him because he was a patriot. And so I was like, oh, is he a British patriot? But then it seems pretty clear as they move forward that no, he was a German spy. Poirot was just impressed by him. I don't know.
The reasons for World War I and World War II and what Germany was doing are completely different, right?
Yeah.
I would love to have thought of Bauerstein as being almost like a double agent.
That's what I had hoped, but I think I was reading into it.
I think he's a World War I spy for Germany. It does make sense, and it also asks my kind of incredulous, like, the world's leading toxicologist is just hanging out at Stiles?
Yeah.
Like, this makes more sense, gathering information, intel, that sort of thing.
And it was interesting, so I did look up a little bit when I thought he was a double spy. There was this big kind of, almost like a myth, that Germany had this really sophisticated network of spies in Britain. Mm-hmm. And they spent a lot of money, the British spent a lot of money trying to infiltrate these spy groups, but it kind of turns out that they didn't really exist. So for a second, I was like, oh, is Bauerstein trying to infiltrate these German spy groups? But no, I think he is the mythological German spy.
That didn't actually exist. Yes.
Yeah.
I think of all of the fake outs, I like this one. There's something just like, oh, this is how this is explained? Great. Because you do get that feeling of like, wait, did I miss something? They arrested Bauerstein? And then it turns out to be something totally different.
There's also just a great, again, Hastings is, we've clearly covered that Hastings is a bit of a doofus. But like Poirot looks at him with his look conveyed a wondering pity at his full sense of the utter absurdity of the idea. And this also kind of reminded me, you know, we always get here that Poirot is really cat-like and he also like hates the dog approach to detection, which we'll get later on. But it really reminded me of like how cats look at humans and they're like, you poor, stupid creatures. And I feel like we definitely get that as Poirot looks at Hastings. Other important things, we get the like kind of bell detail that the wire for the Emily's bell was cut on Monday because she was supposed to die on Monday and she was supposed to be isolated without help. But we learned that it was repaired, so it was all fine on Tuesday. And this just has one of my favorite Poirot being right moments where he learns about his suspicion about the bell was correct and that the murder was supposed to take place on Monday. And he exclaims, I'm like a giant refreshed. I run, I leap. And in the very truth, he leapt gambling wildly down a stretch of lawn outside the window. So I just love that. So like Poirot, no longer a war-weary, wounded veteran. He's just like, he's high on life and being right, which I get.
Yes.
We also get Mary's story. And I love this. Hastings gets further confided in because he's quote unquote kind. And I love that because that is like such poison for Hastings and also just men who want women to be in love with them.
Yes.
It's like, oh, can I treat you as like a one-on-one human to human? And they're like, oh, what? Right. You see me as a friend. Yeah. So this is pure torture for Hastings. But yeah, so we learn that like Mary, I love how complicated Mary is. And I also wonder, I'm like, does Mary actually have a happy ending? I feel like she belongs somewhere else.
I do too. I agree with that. Yeah. Because also the other thing is that we have learned at the beginning of the book that there's like a 15-year age difference between Hastings and John. John's 15 years older, correct?
Yeah.
So how old is Mary?
Oh, that's a really good point. And that maybe she's younger.
Younger than Hastings.
Yeah.
So yeah, she deserves something different.
Exactly. And it's interesting, too, because we also get this idea of like she is a foreigner as well, or she's like the other, but she's also, quote unquote, like the right kind of different because she is sexy and beautiful.
Right.
But we kind of learn that she had this really exciting childhood. Her father was a diplomat and let her travel around the world. And when he died, she was sent to live with this like really boring aunt. And marrying John was her to get out of this bad situation. I love she was direct with him. She was like, John, I'm marrying you because you're going to help me out. I don't love you.
Right.
And he was like, okay, I guess. And so they kind of drifted apart. And she's saying, she's like, I'm not going to stay at Styles. Like, John can stay here, whatever. And we get this, we get like, I want to call this like Hastings' vision, where we get like Hastings's perversion of him, of her. And so he says, I had a sudden vision of broad spaces, virgin tracts of forests, untrodden lands, and the realization of what freedom would mean to such a nature as Mary Cavendish. I seemed to see her for a moment as she was, a proud, wild creature, untamed by civilization, as some shy bird of the hills.
Wow. And then just imagine John Cavendish reading that
report. And Mary too. Like, yeah. She can read.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Mary's like, what, this creep?
Yeah. Oh, Mary, our woman who longs to be free. And so lastly, like, before we get John's arrest, the last little bit that I think is interesting here is that, like, Agatha Christie does something kind of interesting where she points out how crazy this plot is. And this is when Poirot is like, there is literally too much strychnine in this case. He's like, we have found three sources of strychnine. And he names it. He says there's the tonic, there's the bottle sold at the other pharmacy to the fake Alfred, and then there's the one found at the dispensary that Lawrence basically touches because he's curious.
Yeah.
And so I like that she acknowledges it. And I think if she hadn't, people would be like, what the hell? Like, why is there so, there's too much. And so she's like, yeah, there is too much. And this is when we get the very famous phrase of Poirot. He says he needs to use his little gray cells to solve the mystery. And so, yeah, he says the affair must be unraveled from within. And he taps to his forehead, these little gray cells, it is up to them. So he's just saying, like, I need to use my superior intelligence to solve this problem of too much strychnine.
Too much strychnine.
Yeah, which also could be, I don't know, maybe that's the name of the screenplay we write.
Yep, 100%.
Then lastly, the bomb is dropped, John's arrest. It's such a great bait and switch. But in a wonderful way, Poirot, he knows that he is going to be arrested and he's happy. He has quiet triumph when he's arrested because he knows that this trial will bring Mary and John together. And that's the only reason it's going to happen. Like, we could have not gone to Law and Order Part 2 in here. We could have just, like, had the Alfred reveal. But no, we have to sit through another trial so that these two people can fall in love.
Right. In Chapter 11, what ends up happening is that, especially in sharp relief to when Mary was talking to Hastings about the unhappiness of the marriage, Mary defends John.
Yeah.
I don't think it's shocking. It seems inevitable, but it is, I'm more affecting because we understand, like, that they're not this idyllic couple.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then lastly, before we move on to the trial, which I don't even know how much we need to talk about that, but Poirot calls himself Papa Poirot, which also comes up quite a bit. And this is, he's trying to get Mary to confess to him that she went to all those absurd extremes to, like, figure out if John was cheating on her and kind of put her in the mix of that crazy murder night. And so he's like, you can trust Papa Poirot. And I think that might be in my top three favorite Poirot-isms. And so seeing the birth of that in this chapter is a treat.
That's great.
Yeah. And basically, like, the one thing is, he's like, all I need to do to prove the murder is the last link. And he says it over and over and over again throughout this chapter. And then right at the end, Hastings is like saying something kind of in frustration to Poirot about his quivering hands. Mm-hmm. And Poirot's like, oh, thank you. And, like, kisses him on the cheeks and runs away. And chapter 12 is called The Last Link.
There it is.
Should we get into it?
Yeah, let's get into it. Now, Poirot is not there at this point.
Yeah, and I was trying to figure out, so I think for the trial, everyone has moved to London. Like, Mary's taken up, British aristocracy. Right. Mary's taken up residence in London. And Hastings is now working for, he has some kind of government level job. And so everybody is still in London. So I think Poirot is missing because he runs back to Styles. So yes, so the last link, this chapter to me is so exciting because we get the classic Poirot scene that will appear in nearly almost every Poirot book. I feel like in a couple, she's like, I'm going to fake you out. she kind of riffs off of it, but like Poirot specifically is known for this moment where he gathers everyone in the room and reveals all. And it's so, I just want to call it sweet how he like opens it up. He asks Mary, he says, Madame, I have your permission to hold a little reunion in the salon. It is necessary for everyone to attend. It's just so like, seems like such a small ask. And he's opening up just such a big world of like stories and yes. patterns.
Yeah. And those mm-hmm. two lines also are yeah. remarkably consistent with how he gets people to do things throughout the book. He compliments them or he says mm-hmm. something incredibly soft. And then he comes in with the, oh, so you yeah. want to, okay, everyone has to attend? Like, it's like.
He's like, oh yeah. So he gathers Evelyn, Cynthia, Lawrence, Dorcas, Annie, and he makes certain that they all wait until Alfred shows up. Oh, love this. And I love it because Evelyn, this is kind of like Evelyn's last play she can make. She's like, yes. Well, if Alfred is coming, I'm leaving. And he's like, no, 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 stay here. So he starts with the clues. And this is always kind of like the denouement. It's always, it's not right away. You have to like draw it out and everything has to be explained. Mm-hmm. So really the first part of this is debunking that Mary is at all suspicious because she's been weird throughout, right? Like she's weird in the inquest. We know she's lying about like hearing the argument. He starts off by talking about the mysterious green fabric. We learn that it was a Greenland armlet. And I had to look this up and I have some pictures we can put online, which would be really cool.
Sure.
But it's a band that the Women's Land Army wears. And so it's women who like performed a lot of the agricultural land labor during the war. And so like when she gets on her like cow milking gear, because we haven't even really talked about how like Mary gets up every morning at like the crack of dawn to like milk cows. But then the men in this household, like Lawrence is just like, ugh, I'm writing poetry. And like, you know, John is like, give me more money. And like, that's yeah. all they do. Whereas like, Mary's like, she's having intellectual conversations with someone who like happens to be a spy. But then like, she's literally working the land all the time. And I'm just like, what can't Mary do? Right. So anyways, we learn that it's her badge. And we kind of get this Mary's perspective of the night. We learn that like, she was, as we've established before, she was in Emily's room looking for some proof that John was cheating on her because secretly she's starting to fall for him and she's insanely proud and jealous to the point that she needs to put a narcotic in the drinks of Emily and Cynthia to ensure that they're asleep. So she's guilty for sure about doing something and she's the one. Like when kind of all the kerfuffle happens with Emily dying, she just like runs into Cynthia's room and comes back in. And so, of course, the door wasn't bolted. And that's what Lawrence sees and causes yes. him to freak out because he thinks that Cynthia is the one. So like we're getting this big like, OK, we're clearing the room of Mary. We're clearing the room of Lawrence. Then we get that whole timeline, too, of all the arguments that day and the wills getting made and unmade. And it's literally like maybe a 2-hour time period where there is just in Emily's life arguments and a will getting made and then a will getting destroyed.
It's also good to note, getting back to what Poirot has Hastings tell Lawrence.
Yes.
Because then mm-hmm. you know now that he's at ease that Cynthia was yeah. not involved.
Exactly. Yes. I'm so glad you brought that up. Oh, and so the last thing that we get, and this is the award-winning plot point that gets this book written up in the Journal of Medicine.
Yes.
And I had to like really like parse this out because I was like, I don't understand what's happening. So Poirot announces that the strychnine that we really have to care about is Emily's medicine itself. He explains that when you add bromide powders that were part of her sleeping medicine to her other medicine, the strychnine crystallizes and sinks to the bottom, so that when Emily took the last dose, it was just pure and deadly strychnine.
Wow.
Which is so cool. And this is where you can see Agatha Christie's just sitting in the suspensory and she's like, oh God, my day is so boring. And then she's like looking over at the poison cabinet and she's like, how could I kill someone with some of this stuff?
Right.
And then the story was born. So yeah. And so then we kind of learned too, that like the reason why Emily didn't take that last fatal dose was because she was so busy. And then Poirot says, I have the last link. And he produces this note that's to Evelyn saying, like, the murder isn't going to happen on Monday. Don't worry. The old lady is going to be dead on Tuesday. Da 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 da. And someone who's unnamed cries out to tackle Poirot, but he sees it coming. He steps aside and he announces in the most theatrical way possible. He says, Monsieur, Madame, let me introduce you to the murder. Mr. Alfred Inglethorpe. And yes. So we get the like very dramatic reveal that it was Alfred all along.
That sound you just made is perfect because it's like how.
Okay.
So Hastings was right immediately the first time he met him.
Never again.
Never again. So and then used to distract us from that. It was Hastings himself. Oh, it's so smart. Oh,
yeah. So what this is. Yeah, I think that's maybe my favorite scene of the book. It's just so theatrical and all is like finally revealed too. And then you're like, thank God I didn't waste my time reading like chapter 3 and 4 and 5. Like it all makes sense.
Right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So then we have, and I think you and I kind of talked about this quite a bit when we were just getting excited about the book. You had said something really well where you were like, the book opens and it's very serious. And then you had almost described like the middle chapters as like experimental jazz. Mm-hmm. Didn't you describe it that way?
Yeah.
What was the first part? Did you have like a name for that?
I think I was comparing the beginning of this book as being like popular music, like pop music that you hear on the radio. And you're like, yeah, this is, I know exactly what's going on. I can see these beats. And then all of a sudden it just becomes like an experimental jazz festival for like a weekend. And it's, you're like, wait, what? I don't need to hear that many different tones. And it's just, like that's how it felt the first time. But then now you're right. After going through it twice, it all makes sense.
Absolutely. And the thing that, and again, you said this, so I'm giving you credit for it. You were like, well, chapter 13, like if the middle chapters are experimental jazz, you're like, chapter 13 is like a little bossa nova beat.
Yeah.
It was just so perfect. And now I can't not think about the book that way.
Yeah, that's great.
And I see this, it's the ending of this book, but it feels to me like the opening of the rest of the series.
Yes.
Where tonally it's like light, it's breezy, it's all about love and friendship.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's kind of go into chapter 13. It's a couple days later, right?
Yeah, it's a couple days later. And one of the things that we see is like Hastings kind of the weight of how much Poirot knew before him hitting him. Uh-huh. And he has an interesting tone with that.
Yeah, he's like, what the hell? kind of.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and then Poirot, again, I love this so much. He's like, I did not deceive you, mon ami. At most, I permitted you to deceive yourself. And I feel like this, I mean, on one hand, it's great. Like, he's like, I gave you as much as I could. But this really feels like what we talked about before. This is the description of what it's like to read Agatha Christie. And she's like, I'm giving you everything and I am permitting you to deceive yourself. And that's how we're going to have fun. All of it is there. We got the description of the day. We got the description of the night. We have maps. We have lists of clues. And like, we're still just constantly deceiving ourselves. Oh, and the thing that I really wanted to go over, though, how Poirot got that letter. That, I think, is one of the like main new things that we get. The letter from Alfred to Evelyn. And this took some research for me to understand. Hastings clues Poirot into this because he was like, you were standing by the mantelpiece and your hand was shaking in Emily's room. And Poirot's like, oh, and then he like runs away to Styles and comes back. His hand was shaking because that morning when they'd gone into the room, he'd straightened everything on the mantel. And when he came back, his hand was shaking because something wasn't straight. And so he knew someone's been in here. This moment was the starting moment for me where I was like, oh my God, everything that we know about Poirot's personality is a function of this case. Like,
yes,
he needs to be fastidious about order because without that, he wouldn't have had this realization. And then that becomes a character trait throughout the whole thing. So nothing about Poirot's personality is really an accident or very flippant. Like, it's all very intentional. And then out of this book pops this kind of fully formed character that goes on to do other things. The reason why it works for him to hide the paper in this vase called a spill vase is because at the time period around mantelpieces and stuff, they had these vases that were full of like these thin sticks or like these curled pieces of paper. And what you would do is you would use them, like you could stick them in the fire and then the fire would catch to the spill and you could use it to like light a candle or like a cigarette or like a pipe or something. So it's like an easy way of transferring fire around. And I had no idea this existed until about 2 hours ago. And so we can also find like cool pictures of like weird spill vases that are online because you can buy them still. And I think if I remember, Alfred is in that room, breaking open the dispatch case. He has like a 5 minute window, right? Where he's not going to be caught. Like everybody's moving around the house and he's like, I've got to get in now. And he thinks I can't be caught with it in my pocket because then I'm totally screwed. Like if somebody finds that, I'm guilty. Everything is done. So he sees the spills, those like twisted pieces of paper. And he's like, well, I'll mask the letter as the twisted pieces of paper because there's not time to burn it. And also, because of the war, you're not allowed to throw away paper. All paper has to be reused in some kind of way. So, like, wow. You can't throw it away. I know. It's just like, and again, World War I rears its head as a big factor in this story. So that's how Poirot explains that he found that. And then also, and I love this because Poirot was like, I wanted people to be suspicious of Alfred at that moment so that everyone would be watching him and there was no way he could go back at a later time and destroy them. So he literally said he was like, I activated like 10, I think he said, like amateur detectives who were constantly watching him at all times. And I was like, oh, Poirot, you brilliant man. So that's kind of the last revelation really, right?
Yeah, it is. And so this is where we see the, this weird morphing of Poirot from master detective into matchmaker,
mm-hmm.
which is just so fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting that like kind of along the lines of your bossa nova style ending, we really get like very quickly, he's like, okay, here's how I solved it. Now let's talk about love. Let's like put these couples together and let's untie. It feels very Shakespearean, like in a Shakespearean comedy, there's all this mix up about who loves who. And in the end, all the couples are reunited. It really has that feeling. And then the true romance is this friendship between Poirot and Hastings. And like, that's kind of where we end, is the promise of them being friends together and going off into the future.
The first time I read the book, I was like, what the hell is happening here? This is... we just went through this whole thing and now it's like a bromance at the end. And that's okay. That's really interesting. But it took me the second time and then thinking about the world that has just been created and how it's going to be expanded. This Poirot-verse, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
This is the last few lines of the book. And neither of them is for you. Finish Poirot. Never mind. Console yourself, my friend. We may hunt together again. Who knows? And then, that's so fucking good. Like, oh my God. It's just killer. It's just killer. It's such a great last line. Oh.
And the fact that it's a hunt. And you also see, too, that like Poirot loves being around Hastings. He can't deny it. They are buds. Like, he needs a Hastings to have a Poirot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to say, the first time you and I were talking about this book, we were like, oh yeah, there are so many like pop culture references where like these romantic stories end in a friendship starting. And we said a movie that came to our minds at the same time. And yes. I said Casablanca. Would you like to share what you said?
And I said simultaneously, and I have proof that it was completely simultaneous because I have the audio tracks. You said Casablanca, and I said Lethal Weapon.
Both accurate.
Both accurate. 100%. Totally accurate. Yours may be a little more on the nose than mine, but still, yeah.
I think we've kind of closed out the book. Whew, we did it.
Yes.
Applause for us. I'm so proud of us. So I do think that, as you said, as we move forward, the wildly complicated thorniness of it, it's gonna kind of relax. Like, will you and I even need to do a chapter by chapter? Like, could we do chunk by chunk? Like, who knows? But I think for this, like, what a task to summarize.
This may not get left in, but I can understand right now if our listeners are like, the first two episodes were like kind of laser focused and like really, and this one, I think it's really important for you and I, Caitlin, to be true to the book that we're debriefing.
Yeah, we have to reflect the material.
Yeah, it can't possibly be like, oh yeah, we're going to skip this, and no, because it's all in there. Mm-hmm. And if it didn't make sense, if there wasn't this amazing wrap up at the end where like everything is explained, then we'd be like, yeah, let's just not even, there's no reason.
Yeah, why?
But it's all in there. So we got to talk about it. We have to.
We have to talk about it. Oh, I was curious. Did you ever guess who it was when you read it?
No, absolutely not. I know. You know what? I will say that the person who I didn't get at all was Evelyn. How about yourself?
So I had some misses. I went chapter 2, I thought Mary or Lawrence. Chapter 3, John. Chapter 5, John again. So I went back and forth. There is one chapter where Poirot says, oh, here it is. In chapter 5, isn't it strychnine? And the answer is maybe. Poirot says that Alfred is a man of method. And I always, and this is something to keep in mind as we read the next books too, whenever Poirot compliments someone's intelligence, it's a pretty good sign that they're a prime suspect.
Yeah.
And he also insults, he takes it away. Poirot gives and Poirot taketh. He also will say they're not a man of method. And then you're like, oh, that's a big diss. But that was it. But then I like moved on to like a million other people. So I was equally as surprised and confused. We had talked about before, and I just want to bring this up really briefly, but also maybe give this as like a kernel of things for people to think about. And maybe please, this is also probably a really good moment for us to say again, like, what did you experience? Please email us. Like, were you yelling at your phone how stupid we are? Like, we want to hear what we missed.
Right.
And just kind of what you thought. So either by email, or which will be in the show notes, or send us a voice memo too, which I guess you could send that file. So like write us or give us an audio file. We really want to hear what you thought. Something that I thought was cool, but it goes into this category of that's cool, what do I do with it, is that there are all these weird allusions to Hamlet. My thought was like, is it because Hamlet is just like in the cultural ether and it's just everywhere and you can't avoid it? Like, was she reading Hamlet at the time and it like seeped in to this? Or is there something more? Is there the like, so what? And I think that's what I can't get at. So like, please help me out. You had mentioned that there's a lot of theatrics in this. You know, with Hamlet, we have a like a clear play within a play, but like Alfred and Evelyn are performing at all times. And then there's also like, you know, Cynthia, who is this like weird racist male impersonator. And then we have like costumes and just like that sense that like there is a performance happening within this story. And also even Poirot to a degree. Like Poirot is also like, we're kind of in the theater of Poirot's creation.
It doesn't completely work, but there is a little bit to it. If we were to look at John as being Hamlet, Alfred is definitely the guy who marries his mom.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So I can't remember. I just forget all those names. That's
it's like,
amazing.
I know, but we're not supposed to. Yeah. Yeah. So there's all this like kind of like Hamlet adjacent. And then we get the phrase, Hastings describes Poirot as having method to his madness. And I remember thinking like, oh, very naively, and I should have known better. Like, is this where that phrase comes from? And then I looked it up and I should have known this because I teach Shakespeare that, of course, it's like a quote from Hamlet.
Right.
Shakespeare is the reason for like 75% of what we say, for better or for worse. And so, yeah, so we get this quote from Hamlet. And then Poirot, when he's talking about whether he should reveal that John is innocent, and he's kind of deciding, like, do I want to put Mary through a trial and John through a trial so that I can play matchmaker and they can fall back in love? He says something like, to speak or not to speak.
Yes.
That is the question, as you English say, or something like that. And you had made a good point that you were like, well, is he, because like, you know, Poirot will like say things wrong sometimes or have his own like kind of Poirotisms about English. And so you're like, is he misquoting accidentally or on purpose? And you had kind of guessed, and I'm curious to hear more, that you were like, no, he's kind of being cute about it and knows exactly what he's getting wrong.
Yeah, I think that works to his favor. It helps him that maybe Hastings is telling people, this guy's lost it.
Yeah. And later on, like in certain books, Agatha Christie will literally say he like dials up his foreignness. Like,
yes,
his accent and all that, his mannerisms.
Yeah, because I don't think it does any, like Poirot, any good to be potentially schooling British people about Shakespeare.
Okay, true.
Right, like I think he's very aware of his foreignness. And he's got that little niche, mm-hmm. where he likes to stay. I was going to say the other thing too, is that when you were talking about the weird scene between Poirot, Evelyn, and Hastings.
Yeah.
Okay, you know the part in Hamlet where he is talking and he's alone, mm-hmm. but the two guys are listening to him?
Yeah.
And that's kind of the thing about that play when, as an actor, which is that you have to decide right then whether or not you know they're there or not.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a level to the performance that Hamlet knows that? And I wonder if that's a little bit what Poirot is doing there, that Agatha Christie is doing, is Poirot is performing.
Yeah.
That might be a stretch, but I don't know. It just made sense to me.
Yeah. And so I guess my question is like, what do people think about this? Is there anything more we can make of it besides just the like kind of incomplete, these are kind of similar.
Right.
So what is the thought after that? And I don't know.
Neither do I.
Maybe it'll appear. The last thing I wanted to ask before we kind of get to what's coming up, I was curious, like, do you think that we're supposed to take anything concrete away from this? Like, are there any lessons we're supposed to take? And the reason why I ask is because Agatha Christie says of this book that it is a story with a moral. She calls it an old everyman morality tale, the hunting down of evil and the triumph of good. This is what she says, but this is what I think she means. She says, at the time of the 1914 war, we had not yet begun to wallow in psychology. And I think what I can kind of get out of this is that they're not really like so shoegazy yet about like emotion and motivations and complexity. It sounded like she's saying at that time we were really into good, bad. Do you think it's a good, bad story? She says it's a story with a moral. Like, what is that?
I think we can just say without reservation, mm-hmm. that Agatha Christie is a really good writer and absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was trying to increase sales of a book this complicated, that is exactly what I would say.
It's simple, guys.
It's simple. It's totally simple.
That's a great takeaway. The good and evil thing was really interesting because I feel like, yes, Alfred is greedy, but it seems to maintain the class lines.
Yeah.
This greedy upstart and also like maintains the gender lines too. This like masculine woman, these are the bad outsiders. They tried to right. get into these positions that they don't belong in, and look at them fall.
To me, the part of the book, and I wouldn't say less successful, but different than other mysteries I've read, including some of her other ones, is that the motivation for this crime is not really there. We are told what it is, but it to me, it doesn't resonate. It's just like there's this plot that needed to play out. So this is how it had to happen. I couldn't tell you why, and maybe I'm missing something, but I couldn't tell you why Emily fell in love with Albert or Alfred. I don't have enough of a grasp on, was Evelyn and Alfred, is this like what they were doing from the very beginning? If that's the case, then because Alfred seems like a kind of a aloof jerk. So why did Emily fall? Like, these are things that I think are not necessary to explain. It's not like a classic whodunit where everything is cut and dry, except the reasoning behind the clues.
Yeah, we don't get that like human. And maybe that's also where she's like, it's good and bad, black and white. I'm not going to tell you why Emily needed to seek the affirmation of a younger man, or like why Alfred thought that this was a good idea, or the attraction between these two creepy cousins. Like, it's just money. I want money. You have money. I feel like this is really reverberated. I feel like this story is so clearly like a parent of The Glass Onion and other versions where they're like, the murderer is right in front of you. Sorry for the spoiler, but not sorry. We told you this was full of spoilers.
If you haven't seen Glass Onion yet.
Yeah. What are you doing?
What are you doing?
That's also like something kind of that we can open up to people too, is if we're going to take Agatha Christie's word that it is a simple story with a moral and it is not a marketing ploy, which I love that theory. What do people think? Is there like, do you agree with us? Do you not? Like, what do you see as maybe that like moral that Agatha Christie is seeing in her story? I think that this leads us nicely into where we're headed next.
Oh boy.
Do you want to explain it?
Because we love rules so much and we love sticking with the rules. The next book we're doing is not in fact going to be Murder on the Lynx, which would be the second Poirot book. Instead, we're jumping all the way to, I believe, is it 1969?
Yeah, or even 70. Yeah.
Maybe so. Yeah. Uh-huh. So we're Halloween Party is the next book we're reading. It's very, very late. And I believe that you had told me that it is actually the last book she ever wrote, and that she had other ones that came out later that were done.
Yeah, it's the last Poirot for sure. I don't know if it's Poirot. The last one.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, it's the last Poirot, and because she wrote Poirot's Last Case. This is kind of fun. We can talk about it now. But she was like so sick of Poirot. She kind of wrote Poirot's Last Case and had it tucked away in a safe, almost as like an escape clause. She had the end of the series kind of locked and loaded.
Wow.
If she needed to get out of it. Fortunately for us, she stuck with Poirot to the end, which I love, even though she was so annoyed with him. But I think Halloween Party was, yes, the last one of Poirot that she ever wrote. The worlds of difference between Styles and Halloween Party is going to be mind-blowing, and it already is for me, like rereading Halloween Party, because it is the most Poirot-iest Poirot can get. It's peak Poirot. He's gone through everything. It's his most like leveled up Poirot, I guess. He's just so himself, if that makes sense. Like,
yes.
This series has had time to grow into itself, know itself, be self-aware, and like hone what it does best. It is almost unbelievable that it's the same series, I feel like.
I love that we're doing this. We're going from World War I to like swinging 60s,
70s, yeah.
70s London.
Let's just say it. There's some LSD.
Yep, there's some LSD.
So the reason why we're doing this now is that Kenneth Branagh is about to release A Haunting in Venice.
Yes, A Haunting in Venice.
That is based on A Halloween Party. And so we thought that like we would be giving up a huge opportunity to enjoy the new film to its fullest if we like didn't skip ahead to Halloween Party.
Yes.
We were like, this is too good. And I also think it will help, honestly, like, and maybe selfishly for us, like, it's a hint of what's to come. And Murder on the Links, which is the next in the series, and we'll get to that, and it's going to be great. That one is a doozy of a book. It's enjoyable for how wild and insane it is. Honestly, I would recommend doing the audiobook because it is a struggle with a capital S to just like get through the madness of it. But like after that, we really get into this like Poirot that we know. These first two books are kind of this weird, like revving an engine kind of. And so selfishly, I'm like, well, people will continue with the podcast if we have a fun one next. Because they might bail.
Right. Because I think like we start with this book, then we're doing Halloween Party. Then October is going to be Murder on the Links. But then November will be The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which is a seminal work. Unbelievable. I'm glad we thought to break up these first two books.
Yeah. Yeah. You thought too. This just leads us to some like really exciting other spinoffs that we may or may not do. Again, we make no promises, but you know, if we do it, awesome. But can do a lot of comparison between like other versions of like film and TV of the story. So anyways, we're just really excited. And also like, what a fun time I've had putting together the Halloween reading playlist. Oh. It's been really fun. As I sit like in sweltering hot 95 degree weather and I'm like, let's go to Halloween time. It's actually been great. So we're so excited to go through that journey with you next. And for those who like rules and order, do not worry. Murder on the Links is coming. Thanks for sticking with us. Are you still here?
Is everyone still okay?
Yeah. Do you need a break?
Now's a good time to go try to find the phone you threw out of the car window 3 hours ago.
I know.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Caitlin, thank you so much. This has been super, super fun.
You too, Chad. And I guess I'll see you at the Halloween party.
Yes, you will.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Oh my God. That was really fun.